I'm Mike Webb, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. This week, we're going to reveal the true story of how Saddam Hussein's statue was taken down at Firdaus Square during the Iraq War. The author of the piece is freelance journalist Peter Maas, and Peter is the author of Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. He's written for several magazines, including The New Yorker, in which this piece about Saddam's statue appears, as well as The New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, Slate, and Foreign Policy, among many others. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Great to be here.
All right. So why don't we start? Let's set this up a little bit. You were actually in Iraq when the fall of Saddam's statue took place. Why were you there?
I covered the invasion for the New York Times Magazine. And I was one of these crazy, as it turned out, reporters who rented an SUV in Kuwait City and kind of drove it across the border on the first day of the invasion, kind of snuck across. And then a few days into the invasion, realized that I would get shot by American or Iraqi forces if I drove around on my own. So just by chance, when I was north of Nasiriyah, I encountered this battalion that was in a staging area that was heading to Baghdad, as I found out. And I, along with some of these other unilateral journalists, as we were called, asked the commander, the lieutenant colonel, permission to follow his battalion to Baghdad, and he agreed. And this, just as total luck would end up having it, was the battalion that took down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square.
Okay, and then once you got to the square, what did you see?
Well, once I got to the square, I must say that I personally felt great relief, because for the previous 3 weeks, I had been covering this invasion, and it was a very dangerous invasion to be covering, to be a participant in, whatever side of the weapons that you were on. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, it was a relief to be there. And I arrived at the square, pulled up kind of right in front of the Palestine Hotel, in fact. And Colonel McCoy, the battalion commander, also pulled up right there. And so I immediately kind of just went over to him, and he was immediately surrounded by a group of journalists, because journalists were at the Palestine, and these were the first Marines, the first Americans that had arrived, so they kind of conglomerated around him. And then he walked into the Palestine Hotel, surrounded by journalists, with the manager of the hotel at his side, and kind of went in to see what was going on there, to be sure that people were safe, etc., and then came back out. And then when he came out, he kind of saw this toppling process that had already begun. Because while the commander...
Toppling of the statue?
The commander, this whole battalion, had no idea there was a statue at Firdaus Square.
Because he had other concerns.
They had other concerns. It wasn't on their map. Actually, this is one of the kind of strange, interesting things about it all, was that the maps that the commander had, he had a grid for where the Palestine was located. But in that grid, when he looked on the map, there was nothing that said, like, Palestine Hotel here. There was nothing, therefore, that said statue of Saddam Hussein here. So when they drove into Firdaus Square, it was news to them that, hey, there's this big statue of Saddam Hussein here. Some of the Marines did kind of remark to each other, and one of the Marines in the tank company kind of said on the tank company's radio net, you know, hey, take a look at that statue, as they're going in, you know, let's tear it down.
Well, what did they see when they rolled in?
Well, what they saw when they rolled in was an empty square with a statue of Saddam Hussein, a 40-foot-tall statue of Saddam Hussein, dominating it. And it isn't just American soldiers that were tearing down statues. Throughout the course of history, this is what invading armies do.
Right.
You invade a country, you tear down the representations of the regime that you are
opposing.
Right,
you show they're no longer in power.
And this particular battalion had done this before. Not statues, but, you know, posters, billboards, things of that sort. Throughout the entire invasion, throughout other invasions in history, this is what goes on. So it was just kind of natural when they come in and they see this big statue, hey, let's take that thing down. Now, initially, the commander of the tank company told the fellow who suggested taking it down over the radio net, no, we're not going to do that right now. We've got to secure this place. But once they kind of secured it, because there wasn't any enemy there, actually, then this one gunnery sergeant, who was the one who noticed the statue and said, hey, why don't we take this thing down? He then radios his commander, and they're all stationary now, and everything's very secure. Colonel McCoy is inside of the Palestine Hotel. This gunnery sergeant, his name's Leon Lambert, asks his commander, hey, you know, there's some Iraqis here who want to take down the statue. Do you mind if I give them a sledgehammer and a bit of rope? And the captain, who was in charge of this tank company, said, sure, go ahead, but don't use your vehicle. So the gunnery sergeant was the one who started the whole thing. It wasn't started in the Pentagon. It wasn't started in the White House. It was started by this gunnery sergeant who, like any gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps, is all gung-ho to kind of take down the statue. So he hands out the sledgehammer, hands out the rope, and the Iraqis start going at the statue. And the media is all there because they were based at the hotel.
Right.
And this scene of the Marines arriving at Firdaus Square was broadcast from almost the instant that the troops first arrived there.
I don't recall who was broadcasting it.
Pretty much everybody was broadcasting it. Because in the morning, that morning, basically, there were no Iraqi forces at the Palestine Hotel. The journalists were free to do as they wished. Now, there were not American forces there either. So it was still it was a very dangerous place to be because it was in the war zone, undeclared, unconquered territory. So it was still a very, very, very risky time for people there. And although there were some feeds going out, they weren't necessarily being broadcast all over the place because what was there to see? Just an empty square. But because the Marines were so close, and some journalists who were at the Palestine Hotel had gone out and had kind of actually seen the Marines, everybody sort of knew Marines are close and they're going to be coming. And so at CNN, for example, I talked to the executive producer who was in charge of deciding what was going to go on the air. They were aware in the control room at CNN that any moment now, you're going to see Marines coming down into Firdaus Square on this live shot. And so the executive producer at CNN, like executive producers in control rooms and other networks all over the world, not just American, were keeping an eye on their monitors, waiting for that first tank. And the moment they saw the first tank, the executive producer, when he saw that first tank, he shouted out, "There they are." And immediately that feed was put out live on CNN's air.
The Americans coming in to capture this square.
It was a very important moment. You know, this was kind of, you know, the proof that Americans had arrived in the center of Baghdad unopposed. So there was no doubt that this was, you know, worth going live to. The question and the problem then becomes, well, why are you staying there? This statue that's being toppled, why are you there for 2 hours nonstop? Because there's still fighting going on elsewhere. There's looting going on elsewhere. Actually, it's a very complicated situation. And this kind of notion of, you know, utter joy, which was broadcast by the networks, focusing very, very tightly on the very few Iraqis who were at the square, was that really representative of what was going on in Baghdad?
Because there were so many journalists there.
It was...
It just was much more complex than what it looked like on TV.
Most things are more complex than they look like on TV. It's very hard in this really chaotic world. I'm a writer. To kind of do justice to the complexity that exists. TV is a medium that is even more difficult to use to convey complexities of ideas, complexities of emotion, complexities of history. Yet, that's the medium that dominates events such as this. So you had these images that were coming across that were really quite striking, but that's all they were. They were striking. They weren't as meaningful as they were striking. Yet that's what we saw, and that's what shaped our ideas.
Now, I want to jump forward a little bit and just kind of talk about why do you think so many conspiracy theories developed? Was it because it just seemed so easy?
The conspiracy theories developed for a lot of reasons. First off, you know, it did seem a little bit too pat. You know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, is it just coincidence that the American Marines happened to arrive and seize the one target where there's hundreds of journalists? Actually, the non-coincidence wasn't due to the fact that the American military had this great idea to put on a big show from the very beginning. So that wasn't known, why they really went there. What were the reasons for them going there? And so when you don't know, you know, it's easy to kind of suspect the worst, because quite often that is the case. In this case, however, actually, no, there wasn't the forethought that some of the conspiracy theories thought. However, one of the reasons that the kind of... I didn't want to call them conspiracy theories. Let's call them doubts, because they were very legitimate questions and very legitimate doubts. There was an Army report after the invasion about kind of how the whole invasion went. And it actually it was mistaken when it wrote about Firdaus Square, because there was an Army psychological operations team that rolled into Firdaus Square about, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 minutes after this toppling began. And the leader of the psychological operations team kind of seemed to... credit himself with much more in the way of power and influence than he actually had. And the Army report kind of said that, you know, this dramatic event actually was, there was psychological operation teams, our guys were involved in that, and the Army was very glad for that, actually. But the case actually was that this Army psychological operations team really had virtually no role to play whatsoever, but the Army kind of wanted to claim some credit for it. And that fed some of the doubters, because it's like, oh, well, you know, here's the Army saying they had a psychological operations team there, and the psychological operations team was active. The fact was that actually the psychological operation team that was there was not there at the beginning and had no influence whatsoever over it. But that did, and understandably, inform and inflame kind of the people who thought this was all a setup from the very beginning.
Right. Now, your story is not just a first-person account. You went back and talked to all of the players involved. Is that correct?
I went back, talked to, I found, you know, all the players who were involved who I thought were key. You know, the battalion commander, of course, because he's the one who gave the order to take down the statue. His commander, the regimental commander, who had to kind of authorize it. But then also the whole chain of individuals, including, you know, the guy who put the flag up on the statue, the gunnery sergeant who commanded the vehicle that tore down the statue, the Marine whose flag it was that was put up on the statue, as well as a lot of the journalists who were involved in creating kind of this event. And so for me, is the most important thing about the story, kind of, you know, the story within the story that is most important is the one that I tell about Tim McLaughlin, who was a tank commander, whose flag it was that was put up on the statue. And he, as a tank commander, had kind of led the invasion for this battalion, which was a frontline battalion. This was the one that was kind of the fist of the fist. And he is involved in a lot of combat. His tank company killed a lot of enemy soldiers, as well as some civilians by mistake. And I tell his story and how, in the end, he still has the flag. I went to New Hampshire, where the flag is kept actually at a local bank in a safe deposit box. I went to his parents' home. They had taken out of the safe deposit box. And, you know, he looks at the flag. We're in this room with the flag. And he says, you know, it's really not that meaningful to me. There are a heck of a lot more things that occurred during that war that are a lot more meaningful. And then he talked about, you know, the engagements that he had in the invasion where he killed enemy soldiers, the engagements he had where, by mistake, he killed civilians, the engagements he had in which Marines were killed. And he said to me, you know, these are the things that really matter to me. And so, you know, when we talk about war icons, the story is kind of about the making of a war icon, the statue falling, the flag on the face. These aren't the icons that really tell us what war is like. We're looking at the wrong icons. You know, the icons are not ones that are made of metal and cloth. They're made of flesh and blood. And those are the things that we need to be focused on. And so the people who doubt kind of the authenticity of an event, an iconic event like this one, are correct, actually. Even if the event is literally true, and it is visually stunning, it is not true as a measure of what war is like, as an informational source that tells us what this war was like. This is not what we should remember, really, when we remember war, because these victorious moments, I mean, this is not what war is really about. You know, what war is about is the killing of people. And if we sanitize it by focusing only on these kind of joyous, liberatory, or seemingly liberatory moments, we're really missing the point of what we do.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much. It's a really great story, a really great read, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
That was Peter Moss. You can read the full story of the fall of Saddam Hussein's statue at ProPublica.org and in the New Yorker magazine. And now for our official Say Fave Tumblr of the Week. Illinois comptroller Dan Hines, in an interview on 60 Minutes, said the following about his state's fiscal troubles. Quote unquote, "The state of Illinois is known as a deadbeat state. This is a reputation that has taken us years to earn, and we've reached, you know, the heights of, I think, becoming the worst in the country." Congratulations, Dan. That's this week's show. This podcast was produced by Quadia Muhammad. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll see you next week.